And then then we move on. That is, once the mind has been somewhat calm, the stability is more coherent, can be sustained over time without getting uptight. And that really is a key to the contemplative training of attention. That is, attention, very high pitch or high arousal attention, is imperative for a number of occupations. I was just speaking with somebody who knows a sniper, a man who actually was in war as a sniper. Because I've been referring to snipers for a long time, but never actually met one. Well, I've met one now, only one step removed. And to hear what's it like to be a sniper who actually aims not at targets, but at people, with very, very focused attention. And snipers often have to remain very still. They don't just pop up and shoot. They have to be burrowed in someplace, camouflaged. We've all seen this, at least on movies or what have you. They have to be very, very still. And then their target comes. They have to be totally focused. And then, with unwavering mindfulness, then strike their target. And one, I got this just one step away. One experienced sniper said that when you settle in that way, the mind becomes very focused. There's a definite kind of calm that settles on the mind. Quite interesting. You're about to kill someone, but the mind becomes very calm, very quiet, because everything around you is collected now to do this one deed. But generally speaking, in the cultivation of attention, let's say in warfare or in jet fighter pilots, air traffic controllers, chess, music, a number of other occupations that require a high level of attention, is exhausting. It's exhausting. You do it for a number of hours, and then you're tapped out. You're very tired, strained, and you really need some R&R, some just rest and relaxation afterwards. But the meditative cultivation of attention is just the opposite. It's coming out of a deepening pool of relaxation. So I was just speaking with one of the three-month retreats, the other person completed the second retreat just a couple of days ago. And they both had a very, very meaningful experience in these three-month shamatha retreats we held last year, and were so enthused by their own experience, so inspired by it, that they both decided to continue on for at least a year and continue practicing. So one is practicing now. I was on the phone with him 2 days ago, 10 hours a day. He said, I can only do 10 because I keep on even do shopping and cooking and that kind of thing. I'd like to push the envelope, but, you know, these logistics keep on keeping me only to 10. The other person I spoke with, 12 hours. 12 hours a day, and in four-hour sessions, 4 hours sitting in meditation, didn't even mention any physical distress, and maintaining a remarkable degree, a very, very high degree, of focus, of calm, and both of them experiencing a very deep sense of well-being flowing right out of their practice. Neither one was attending to any pleasant object. It's a quality of well-being that's simply arising because the mind is so balanced. And so they wanted to check in with me, but they didn't have any problems. And I was ready, you know. I came loaded. I'm prepared. I can help you out. You have some problems here. What are your problems? And they've been meditating now for quite some time. And they didn't mention a single problem. Just a little bit of clarification here, clarification there. But not a single problem. I found that very encouraging. That after 3 months of a lot of instruction, I was meeting with them 2 hours a day collectively and met with every one of them one-on-one once a week, that they got enough in those 3 months that they really now can be pretty much on their own. And there are a little cluster of them out there in southern Colorado meditating away and pursuing this as true contemplative scientists. So that was very encouraging. And so in the practices, in the shamatha retreat that we held last year, the initial practice that I taught, a lot of people adopted at least for some time, was mindfulness of breathing. But then there's a practice of observing the mind, and that is still honing the attention skills, but taking as your object the space of the mind, that dimension of experience that is purely mental in nature. That you can't see with the eyes, you can't hear with the ears. So discursive thoughts, internal chit-chat, mental images, memories, desires and emotions, and so forth. So one focuses single-pointedly on a domain of experience that is purely mental, that which is left over once you've fallen asleep and you're dreaming. Well, this is a very major practice in Tibetan Buddhism, but now let's slip right back over to the Western tradition, the Western Christian tradition, way back to the 7th century. Hesios the priest writes, "One type of watchfulness, which is another word for mindfulness, consists in closely scrutinizing every mental image or provocation." It's interesting phrasing. Every mental image that is to your mind's eye, everything that arises as an appearance to you. Maybe it's a mental image. Maybe it's mentally hearing some chit-chat or a line of dialogue or even a whole conversation. So there's that which arises to you in meditation, internally, arising objectively. And then, he says, provocation. More of a subjective impulse that is noting, with this very spacious awareness, noting the arousal of impulses such as desires or intentions, emotions, which do not appear to you as an object. You don't see them over there, but you're aware of them arising in the space of the mind as an impulse or a provocation, and one closely scrutinizes, one closely applies mindfulness to whatever's arising in the mind. Fascinating practice. Here's one type. He says, a second type of watchfulness consists in freeing the heart of all thoughts. That is now not attending to the thoughts, but as soon as they arise, just releasing them. Freeing the heart of all thoughts, keeping it profoundly silent and still. So now a shift, not attending to them, but just remaining in an ongoing flow of watchful stillness, silent stillness, vigilant, clear, precisely in the moment, but not even taking an interest in the contents of the thoughts, releasing them on sight, and dwelling for more and more protracted periods in a sheer silence of awareness. This inner stability produces a natural intensification of watchfulness, that is, the sheer acuity, the arousal, the vividness, luminosity of watchfulness is enhanced, and this intensification of watchfulness gives contemplative insight into spiritual welfare. I think this is simply brilliant. By any standard, Buddhist, Christian, secular, this is absolutely a marvelous array of practices here. Spiritual welfare. We know that there's a certain type of pleasure that arises from encountering pleasant stimuli. Nice people, good food, pleasant sounds, happy thoughts, right? Images that are lovely, a really cool dream. These are all things happening to us, arising as appearances to the mind, and we can get a kick out of them. That is, they can arouse a certain pleasure, and I have called that hedonic pleasure. And some of it is very sweet. But there's hedonic pleasure, and then there's psychological welfare, psychological well-being that is arising more from the inner balance of the mind. By balancing the tension, what was referred to just earlier with mindfulness of breathing, there you are, you're really not attending to anything terribly interesting. The sensations of the breath are not scintillating. I mean, they're pretty much, you've seen one, you've seen them all. But the quality of attention that's being honed, the balance of the mind, then gives rise to what one can call a psychological welfare or well-being, now not hedonic in its nature, that is, it's not a sense of well-being or happiness that's arising from some pleasant stimulus, but that the mind, your psyche, is coming into a state of balance and it feels good. Just like a really healthy body can feel just really good, even if you're not getting a massage or doing something nice to it, just the body feels good psychologically when it's balanced. When the mind is balanced, there's a psychological welfare. But Hesios the priest is referring to something even beyond that. And that is, as one silences the psyche, just reduces it to silence, what does he call it? This keeping it profoundly still, silent and still. You're no longer even concerned with your psyche. Your female mind, your male mind, your young mind, older mind, Anglo mind, Hispanic mind, not interested. That is, whatever it is, you say, you know, been there and done that, I'm now going to a deeper dimension. I'm not certainly not interested in hedonic pleasures. We moved away from that in the movement of renunciation. But now I'm not even interested in the thoughts, those distinctive characteristics or processes of my own mind. I'm going to release that and see what lies even deeper. And he says this intensification of watchfulness gives contemplative insight into spiritual welfare, spiritual well-being that is beyond the psychological, that's tapping into a deeper source. And when the Christians use the word contemplative, they're referring to something very deep that's going to core issues, absolutely essential elements of our existence. Brilliant presentation. Here's one of the major contemplatives and scholars from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, here 17th century. This was Panchen Losang Chukyi Gyantsen. He was the tutor of the great fifth Dalai Lama, who was a great statesman, a great contemplative, great scholar, therefore called great. This was his tutor, one of the Panchen Lamas. And he writes, now, observing the mind in Buddhist tradition, Here's his explanation of the practice. Whatever sorts of thoughts arise without suppressing them, recognize what they emerge from, there's a typo, what they are emerging from, and what they dissolve into, and stay focused while you observe their nature. So here's the practice of attending to whatever thoughts, what did he call it? Images and provocation, mental image and provocation. It looks like the same practice. And that is simply observe them, observe what from what they arise and into what they dissolve, and stay focused while you observe their nature. In other words, watch the whole genesis of thoughts to the best of your ability. I was just teaching this recently. I think maybe most recently in Kansas City. I came back a couple of days ago. And people were saying when they tried to observe the mind, they found that they were able to identify thoughts, usually only after they had arisen. So it was kind of retrospective. Oh, I see I've been carried away. Oh, there's a thought. When did you come in, right? But as one hones the skill, and this is certainly possible, it's been replicated many, many times, as one hones the skill of observing the mind, you may be there in the birthing room when the thought, the image, the memory, or even the desire or an emotion arises. You may be there right when it initially arises, without being absorbed into it. Be aware of it, and then as it plays itself out, whatever it may be, a line of thought, a sequence of images, be present with it as it plays itself out, and then finally it dies a natural death. And that is a sequence of thoughts, images, or what have you, or a desire, an impulse, a provocation. They don't last forever. They come up, they emerge, and then sooner or later, they're going to dissolve. And what this Panchen Lama is suggesting here is that just let thoughts arise without suppressing them, without editing, reacting to them, judging them. Be just utterly cognizant of what's arising, what they're arising from, what are they dissolving into, and for as long as they are present, simply observe their nature. By doing so, eventually, the motion of thoughts ceases, and there is stillness. Interesting parallel there. We noticed that earlier in the Christian practice of mindfulness of breathing, there was a little bit of control, not much. But to recall, he said, breathe in, then pause for just a moment, and then release out. In the classic Buddhist tradition, there's no control at all. And that is, one makes, it would be awkward to say one gives a lot of effort to not exerting any effort. But the point there is that, to the best of your ability, you just let the breathing flow without any kind of regulation, preference, control, any willful intervention whatsoever. And then naturally, the breathing gradually calms, becomes more sinusoidal, very rhythmic, and quieter in the process the mind does become subdued. We saw in the previous slide, first of all, observing thoughts, and then he says, okay, now shift gear and just terminate the thoughts. As soon as they come up and rest in silence and in stillness, Panchen Losen Chögyi Gyaltsen has said, well, you know, you don't really need to take that active role to deliberately terminate the thoughts. Just settle more and more in a sense of ease, of relaxation, of non-grasping, and utterly naturally, without your intervening or regulating in any way, eventually the coming and going of thoughts will cease, and you will be left with stillness. Each time you observe the nature of any thoughts that arise, they will vanish by themselves, following which a vacuity appears. So as you go deeper into this practice and simply observing without identifying with the thoughts, just being utterly, luminously, discerningly present, with whatever arises in the space of the mind, then they arise, but they don't proliferate. Normally, when we're hung up in our thoughts, we're identifying with the thoughts, caught up and carried away by them, one thought arises and immediately it's kind of an avalanche effect, right? It gives rise to association and then emotions start coming in and there's emotional associations and it brings in more thoughts and we just get totally tangled up. And we call that thinking. That's the normal thought. Actually, we're being a thought, you know? It's more something that happens to us. It's rather compulsive and obsessive in many, many cases. But here, it's not a suppression of the thoughts, but simply letting them be, letting them arise, but without the entanglement, without the identification with, just being very present with them. And then gradually, number one, the proliferation doesn't take place. They arise, and they're orphaned. As soon as they arise, and then just, they dissolve right back into the space. That will happen. And then you'll have longer and longer interludes between the arising of these adventitious or just thoughts arising seemingly out of nowhere. They'll arise with larger and larger lapses or longer lapses in between. And then gradually a vacuity arises and you're simply left with a three-dimensional, luminous, empty space. It's called the substrate or the empty space of the mind. Likewise, if you also examine the mind when it remains without movement, again, he's giving a whole sequence here, just like the previous contemplative did. Now, once you've settled the mind, this is a whole sequence. He put it in so few words. But you attend to the mind, the lapses get longer, they dissolve, you're left with vacuity. There you are, vividly attending to virtually nothing at all. And then you might notice, in fact, it's a natural thing. It happened many times in the 2-3-month retreats last year, that as you're attending to this vacuity, it's almost like a groundswell from the subjective side of your awareness. A swell starts to arise, and you simply become more and more vividly aware of the sheer event of awareness taking place. You were attending to the space that was appearing to you, okay, an appearance of vacuity, not very interesting. But then just you're kind of overwhelmed. You start to just be suffused in the sheer event of awareness happening from moment to moment to moment, an ongoing flow of knowing. And you may then attend to that. No longer are you attending to thoughts. They vanished. No longer are you attending to the vacuous space of the mind. But now you're letting awareness invert right in upon itself. And you examine the mind when it remains without movement. Your awareness now is still, and you're simply observing that still awareness. And you will see an unobscured, clear, and vivid vacuity without any difference between the former and latter states. So you're resting in now this rather undifferentiated space of awareness where the space is not over there, the awareness is not over here. It's a non-dual luminous vacuity. That is well known among meditators, and it is called the union of stillness and motion. The stillness is in the very space of awareness itself, and the emotion is now and again, you're bound to have a little, like a bubble arising up in an aquarium, just a single bubble down from the sand on the bottom. I used to have an aquarium, I remember seeing it. It just goes, and it comes up and just goes on the surface, but that's pretty much it. There's hardly any repercussions out of that, just one little bubble and hardly any ramifications out of that. But even while the mind is in motion, thoughts perhaps arising, coming, and going, there is a stillness, and simultaneously you're experiencing the stillness of your own awareness with which you are aware of the movements of the mind. One Lama is given the metaphor of being the gracious host in the midst of unruly guests. The gracious host is the stillness of your awareness, the unruly guests, the coming and going of thoughts, images, desires, and so forth.